I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, guys. Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Oh my goodness, it's Behind the Bastards, the podcast where Michael Swaim and I talk about how Christopher Columbus was actually kind of a cool guy. Michael, how do you know, a lot of people get angry at him because of the slavery and the genocide, but...
I hadn't heard that, but go on.
Have you considered, is it Ohio that has a Columbus? Or is it Missouri has a Columbus? Both of them have a Columbus, don't they?
Maybe both. At least Ohio.
At least one American state has a town called Columbus, and I'm going to say they have good pizza? I don't know. Mm. Nobody knows. Michael, you play video games, right? You're a big video games guy.
I eat pizza. I play video games. I'm a regular guy, Robert.
You are. I should introduce you first. Not that you need introductions.
No, I don't need to, because as you said, the format is and always has been Robert Evans and Michael Swaim talking about Christopher Columbus.
That's another episode. That's every episode of this show. Michael, you are the only member of the cracked diaspora who has visited me in my new home. I guess I could say that it's probably because of the plague, but I think it's a direct personal insult. But in any case, when you were here, you brought out a machine which allowed you to play video games on my television, a gaming console, right?
That's right.
And that made me think, this was like a year ago now, but I've been thinking ever since, boy, it seems like it'd be nice to sit down on the couch and play a video game old fashioned style. See, I don't have a lot of hobbies anymore, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking about it. And yesterday, I don't know why, I was feeling kind of depressed. And I was like, I am going to play a video game on the couch. But I didn't have it. I don't have a console. I don't have any way to do that. So I go down to the video game store and I'm like, I would like one PlayStation or Xbox. It doesn't matter. And they told me, you can't do that. You have to get an invitation to buy one. That's the way that all gaming consoles work now. And so I just need to ask you as a video game guy, what the fuck is going on with video games? Why can't you just go buy a video game machine?
Well, if you collect 6 Steam Decks, then your punch card is full and you can get a PS5. No, it's my understanding is that full disclosure, I used to work at IGN and I would know this shit. I've lapsed. That was like 4, 5, 6 months ago. So I believe, though, that should be turning a corner soon, actually. Okay. The chip shortage and the video card shortage kind of has already broken. That's those 3080s.
I have no idea what I have. I've got a gaming laptop that I bought a year or so ago in another fit of depression. And so I realized eventually, why am I trying to buy a PlayStation? All I want to do is play Grand Theft Auto 5. I can just download that on Steam and buy a controller and plug it all into my TV. So it's fine now. I figured it out. But I was
did
briefly
you go
like
back and punch that clerk in the mouth square.
No,
mouth?
He was like, yeah, I mean, he wasn't being rude. It's just like, I didn't realize we'd gotten to there with video game consoles, yeah, where you have to get an invitation, like dinner with a shake.
Extremely
like, what
scarce,
what is happening
yeah
here?
I remember at work when the PS5s were coming out, they told us all to sign up for X number of lottery tickets, because if we didn't get enough consoles to go around for the staff, we wouldn't be able to cover stuff, which is the entire livelihood of the
God, what
publication.
A weird,
it's wild.
What a yeah weird situation.
Pandemic.
Yeah, it's something else, Michael. Michael, we're talking about Christopher Columbus, Michael Swaim, Small Beans Network, formerly of Cracked.com.
That's right. Please don't put my name
director
directly next to him.
Of the film Kill Me Now.
That's true.
Michael, yes. You ready to get back to Columbus?
Absolutely. Okay. Ohio right or otherwise.
Yeah. So, Michael, as our story comes back, it is 1492. Now, Columbus has done sailed his ass right across an ocean blue, and he stumbled into a Caribbean island full of people who he immediately thinks are, number one, hot. He repeatedly comments on how good looking they are. And number two, good potential servants/slaves. Now, according to his journals, the first thing he focused on trying to do was convert them to Christianity, and most importantly, to make sure that they thought that all white people were chill dudes. Now, he did this in a couple of ways, mainly by handing out various trinkets. Here's how he wrote about it in his diary. I, in order that they would be friendly to us, because I recognized they were a people who would be better freed from error and converted to our holy faith by love than by force, to some of them I gave red caps and glass beads, which they put on their chests, and many other things of small value, which they took so much pleasure in and became so much our friends that it was a marvel. And one of the things that's, like, really funny here is that he thinks, like, you get all these writing from the Spaniards at the time about how silly these people are, because they'll, like, trade gold gems for, like, useless baubles. Mm-hmm. But none of them ever considered the fact that, like, maybe to these people, they're both useless. That, like, a glass bead and gold are both about as valuable to each other, right? Like, neither of them do anything. They just look nice.
If you've never gotten high and had the thought, gold is just a rock, though, man. Yeah. Like, it's just a rock. Someone just decided.
It's just a rock that sat out in the sun the most, according to Plato.
And by the way, handing out red caps, I believe this is the official origin of the MAGA cap, so you can lay that at Columbus' feet as well.
He started it. You might draw, I don't know. I don't know enough about fucking Italian history in this period to know how meaningful it is, but, like, you got to remember, he comes from a place where colored clothing is illegal. So I don't know. That's interesting.
Like, we got the latest hot shit. This contraband.
Look at this, kids.
It's
fucking red.
The color of passion, my friend.
You don't tell the Pope, and I won't tell the Pope.
My rods and cones are overwhelmed.
And it's worth noting that, like, while this is often referred to as gift giving, like him handing out trinkets, it seems based on the descriptions you get that, like, the natives consider that they are consciously, like, entering an exchange with him. Like, he's giving them stuff that they assume he values because they're giving him things that they value, right?
They're assuming he's not being a huge prick. Like,
yeah, they are assuming
prick.
He's not being an asshole. They're like, oh, we got to give him some nice stuff. He's giving us all this nice stuff that we've never seen before. Like, they're giving him nice cotton thread and, like, live parrots, which Columbus thinks are delicious. You got to give him credit with one thing. I don't know. I found this compelling, at least. A lot of the Spaniards, especially once they start settling in these islands, refuse to eat the local food. It's actually a massive problem. They have to, like, keep shipping livestock over from Spain because people decide that, like, their cuisine is gross. Columbus is not one of those guys. He actually gets sick a bunch because he will eat anything these people hand him, which, credit where it's due, that's how you're supposed to travel.
Yeah. True.
So one item he would give them in return are these tiny hawk's bells. And these are, like, if you're doing falconry, these are, like, little bells that you tie to birds and use to track them when they're, like, flying away. I guess it's just a thing that it was easy to get a lot of so that they could have a shitload of these to hand out. But he gives out a lot of hawk's bells, and that's going to be noteworthy later. So just keep the hawk's bells in mind.
Yeah, they're the Livestrong bracelets of the era.
If the Livestrong bracelets led directly to a suicide genocide, yes.
Here we go, Columbus people. Yeah. Buckle up.
The people who lived on the island that Columbus had discovered and then taken possession of for the crown were Tainos, members of the Arawak group. Now, over the coming days, he met with many different like people on this island, many different like kinds of Arawaks, because there's all these different, right? Like, it's a pretty broad population, you know? And I think these are kind of like grouping by languages. And these guys give him a bunch of gifts of unknown types. You know, he writes down some of them, but usually he just writes it down as like, they gave us trinkets. We don't actually know what that means. They may have been like handing him works of art, decorations, clothing, stuff that like mm-hmm. could be, because these people believe, a lot of them at least, believe that he's like like some sort of celestial visitor, right? So it's possible they're giving him like cultural artifacts of significant value to them. And he's just like, yeah, they just gave me some crap because it's not gold, right? Like, that's the only thing that he actually ever seems to notice. He calls just their gifts tedious.
Fishing around his ridiculous pantaloons. Yeah. What do I got? What do I got in here?
The only things that he like shows any appreciation for are the small pieces of gold jewelry that he sees on some of their bodies. Now, it's worth noting that our friend Carol Delaney absolutely fawns over the descriptions Columbus writes of people and geography. She glosses over the fact that she talks about like what a good like anthropological attention to detail that he does, that he has, which is interesting because he's also like dismissing all of these different gifts they're giving him as trifles, which I would say is bad anthropology, but I'm not an anthropologist here. So in short order, Columbus takes his little fleet away from this first island, which is probably San Salvador, and heads towards Cuba, which he thinks is Japan, right? And he will think that until the day he dies.
They were his last words, in fact.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's you run into ceviche, you think it's sushi. It's happened to all of us, you know? Same food, basically.
Different order.
Yeah. So he decides that... And part of the reason why he's so like fired up to get to Japan, number one, he's still looking for that Great Khan, right? He's still looking for like some evidence of these massive Asian civilizations that he knows are supposed to be here and supposed to be ready for Christianity. And the other thing is that based on his kind of like these conversations he's having with the locals, and they're not really conversations as well as much as like kind of gesture-based discussions, but he kind of puts together that the gold he's found, the little pieces of gold, came from that island. So he's like, all right, that's where the gold comes from. And obviously, that's the number one thing. So as he leaves this first island and heads for Cuba, he captures a bunch of people and takes them with him. These are random locals that he imprisons on his ship to ask as guides. Now, in her book, because she's terrible, Carol Delaney describes these people as willing and eager guests, friendly natives excited to show the white people around. This is not true. These captives told Columbus that there was an island. Like, part of the evidence for the fact that these people were not willing guests is that they told Columbus... Like, as they're sailing to Japan, Cuba, they tell Columbus there's an island on the way, and they're like, oh, yeah, we've seen people there, and they have, like, these huge gold bracelets that they wear on their arms and legs. It's the most gold anyone has around here.
Go fuck with them for a while.
We'll take you there. We'll introduce you to them, right? And as soon as they get to the island, all of the Taino prisoners he's taken run the fuck away. They absolutely... they fucking escape. So he's annoyed by this, and he sends an armed party to the shore to recapture them or to capture somebody else. He feels like since he's gotten close to the island, he can't go past it without taking possession of it, right? The exact way he writes this is that it was my wish to bypass no island without taking possession. And this is another thing Carol fails to mention. So I'm going to quote from Lawrence Bearguine's book next. Quote, he dispatched several seamen in hot pursuit of the fugitives, chasing them ashore. But, as he ruefully noted, they all fled like chickens. When another dugout canoe innocently approached with a man who came to trade a skein of cotton, some of the sailors jumped into the sea because he wouldn't come aboard and seized the poor fellow as a replacement detainee. Observing from his vantage point on the poop deck, Columbus sent for him and gave him a red cap and some beads of green glass, which I placed on his arm, and two hawk's bells, which I placed on his ears. That is, the standard issue trinkets of little value, and I ordered him back to his dugout. So his plan here was to bait the hook. He wanted the locals to approach him with trust so that he could capture more of them. Right. So he like takes this guy, puts him back on his boat with a bunch of trinkets and sends him off. Hopefully so that he can like question the others about gold and all that stuff. And this tactic is pretty successful. People are generally very friendly for him. And there's a few reasons for this. Some of it is that he is giving people gifts from time to time, and so they'll go back and be like, there's some dude and he's handing out shit, let's go meet him. And the other reason is that, as Columbus kind of surmised, they saw him as and his men as, quote, men who came from the heavens. Now, it is hard for us to know precisely what their beliefs were here, right? We don't have the kind of context that we would like, because they are genocided. It is generally,
I mean, he took all their art and shit and labeled it trinkets, and
trinkets,
we just
threw
that
shit overboard.
Yeah.
It is generally accepted that the people indigenous to a lot of these islands had popular beliefs. And again, you're talking about multiple groups of people, right? They're all under these kind of broad language groups, but that doesn't mean they're like, they're often at war. They have different opinions of each other. Like, right. Very likely that some of these people had popular beliefs that divine or divinely inspired beings were going to visit them one day. And it was kind of like a prophecy. Sometime it may have been kind of like an apocalyptic prophecy. Maybe sort of, you might even view it as a little bit like kind of Christian rapture, like readiness, you know, there are beliefs like that all over the world.
It's
right?
core to almost every religion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ultimately. Just that, at some point in the distant future, we will meet this magical thing. It's human nature to want to eventually meet or connect with or be one with the thing you made up. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of those things. So there probably were some prophecies that sort of led some subset of the people he's meeting to believe that he and his Spaniards are divine visitors or celestial visitors or something ethereal and otherworldly. Mm-hmm. It's also worth noting, though, that whenever we talk about prophecies like this, there's like a nasty tendency to act as if these beliefs are universal. It gets flattened. So we say the people of these islands believed this or that. And we're talking about large decentralized groups on many islands. Human beings just don't work that way, right? They don't all believe the same thing just because they all live in the Caribbean. And oddly enough, there's a passage from Carol Delaney's book that does a decent job of making this clear. It's one of the little pieces of kind of insight we get into how varied beliefs might actually have been on the ground.
Please note, this is the beginning of Robert's turn to pro Carol Delaney. By the end, he's super pro.
Well, you know, I haven't found this anecdote and the other stuff I've read about Columbus, and I found it fascinating because it answered this question I always had as a kid when you'd hear like, oh, they believed this or that. And it's like, well, they didn't all, right? Because we don't, you know, like there must have been sects and schisms. And anyway, I find this interesting. At one stop, an old man who had heard of Columbus approached him with a desire to engage in a theological discussion. Perhaps he had heard that Columbus was interested in religious beliefs, or he may have cleverly used this dialogue as a way to protect his people. Columbus, for his part, must have jumped at the chance to have a discussion with a learned native about their beliefs. They talked about the soul and what happens to it after death. The old man explained that his people believed that any injury to the body also affected the soul, and begged Columbus not to injure any of the people. Columbus assured him that he only hurt bad people because that was what his sovereigns had commanded. Unlike others who believed Columbus was some kind of god, this man told Columbus that to his face that he was, quote, mortal like everyone else. Columbus was not offended and wrote that the old man expressed his thinking with excellent judgment and courage. So that's interesting to me. Yeah, you get these little like hints of the variety of beliefs and thoughts that might have existed in this population.
Oh, yeah. And just the recurring motif of, don't worry, I only hurt bad people.
I only hurt bad people.
The core of all Western civilization.
He is. We talk a lot on this show about like whiteness and the fact that whiteness is like an idea with shifting boundaries that changed over time. But you might say Columbus was the first white guy. Like,
he sounds like one for sure. Yeah. He's got the talk right.
He's got it all right. You could put this guy in like the George Bush White House and he could be delivering fucking press conferences on carpet bombings. It's great. So as much as she tries to paint him as an unbiased, open-minded cultural anthropologist, Columbus's own writing makes it clear that his only interest in these people was using them to find and mine gold for his Jerusalem goals. He wrote very little about their actual culture. He brushed over their religion. Again, you have to remember that what he said about their religion is they don't have one, right? Because he didn't understand it, so he assumed that they were just like a blank slate ready for Christianity. He ignored their social order almost entirely. He didn't really understand the way they were ordered and who was in charge. He showed very little to no interest in their agriculture, except to rave about the quality of their food. And even that may have been kind of out of desperation as much as anything, because as the days wore on, they keep not finding gold, right? They get these little trinkets, but there's no sign of these gold mines that he had told the king and queen were going to be here in, like, huge quantities. So he may have been playing up the only stuff that he thought was of value, right? Because, he doesn't care about the, like, the people or their culture. So he's like, well, the food's pretty good. Maybe we can take that.
I'm just imagining flying saucers coming. And we're all excited about first contact, and aliens arrive, and they're like, is Arby's open? And they order a bunch of shit, and we're like, do you want to have, like, cultural interchange? And they're like, don't bother us.
No, Arby's. You're good.
I don't care about that, dude.
Yeah. And then one of them writes home, gets, like, asked by his boss, so do humans, is, like, religion a big deal for them?
No,
I don't think so,
religion.
Man. I don't really think it's a big deal. Arby's, though.
Yeah.
They got the meats.
It's two of these things for $6. It's brilliant.
It's like walking around Jerusalem looking for a fucking sandwich, being like, wow, these people don't have a religion at all.
Meanwhile, you have an abduction quota, and it doesn't matter who. Doesn't matter.
Just take them all.
It's just numbers. Yeah.
Well, we are getting to the abduction quota. So the main thing that he does in his writing here, rather than, again, Carol Delaney is, like, just fucking hard as hell about trying to portray him as, like, this like, anthropological savant. I think Lawrence Bergreen gets it more correctly when he describes Columbus as writing about the new world that he's found as a, quote, tabula rasa in which his sovereigns would leave a lasting imprint of empire. Columbus wrote that, quote, your highnesses will command a city and fortress to be built in these parts and these countries converted, and I certify to your highnesses that it seems to me that there could never be under the sun lands superior to them in fertility, in mindfulness of cold and heat, in abundance of good and pure water, and the rivers are not like those of Guinea, which are all pestilential. Which is obviously the Portuguese have Guinea, right? So he's trying to, he's not, to the extent that he describes all of this lovingly, he's not doing it out of legitimate interest. He's doing it to try to make it attractive to the king and queen.
It's a sales pitch.
Yeah, it's a sales pitch.
He's shown no interest in learning these things.
No.
It's gold. It's just gold.
Yeah, it's a sales, in part because, as per the deal he has with them, if this turns into a colony and there's trade, he gets like a quarter of the profits forever. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's part of why he's trying to sell them on this place. Everything he's writing is like, he's like a fucking, I don't know if you, he's a salesman, right? Like that's what he's trying to sell is this land other people live on. And part of the way he's selling that is like, and they're barely even real. Like they're not here. They don't care. Like they'll do whatever we want them to do. Yeah.
He's playing life like it's Civ 3 before they had all the like theism and additional mods. It's just, I clicked on your shit, dude. It's my color now.
It's my stuff now. Yeah. So a write-up from American Heritage summarizes Columbus's feelings after first contact with the Arawak on San Salvador. Quote, 2 days after the first landing of the expedition on the tiny island of Guanahani in the Outer Bahamas, which Columbus christened San Salvador, when your highnesses so command, they could all be carried off to Castile or be held captive in the island itself, he wrote, because with 50 men, they could all be subjugated and compelled to do anything one wishes.
He said the line. I know that line.
Yeah. Now, the Taino did try to introduce Columbus and his men to their food and to various inventions of their culture. And some of these did take. The most exciting invention that they found, that the Europeans found, was the hammock. They had not invented hammock technology yet. We get our word hammock from the Arawak language. And this is a big deal because, like, among other things, right, think about a boat and the way boats are constructed. People don't have rooms on boats in this day. So you're just all sleeping in a pile around whatever ship's boy is, like, too slow to evade capture by the mob.
Right.
Yeah.
The image is just sailors, like, on the floor on a shelf sleeping. Yeah.
The hammock is going to revolutionize sleeping on boats.
Wow.
You know, anyway, so, you know, there was a genocide, but at least the world got the hammock.
We got the hammock. It's a great, it is. I want to see that packaged as a PSA. Hammocks, worth it? We think so.
The United Hammock ad pitch. It's just like a devastated land, mass graves. Yeah. The hammock, worth it?
A Native American in a hammock. Yeah. A single tear. Mm-hmm. We know the drill.
So slowly, as the days turned into weeks, Columbus and his crew began to learn bits and pieces of the local language. Now, the most important phrase that they learned was "Don't be afraid." And pro tip, God, if somebody
that's chilling, yeah,
that's chilling. It's really fucked up, right? If anyone starts a conversation, that's the number one way to know someone means to hurt you. If they start by saying "Don't be afraid," then you need to be very frightened. That's a shooting word, Michael. Yeah. That is a shooting phrase. If an alien comes to my door saying that, I am not going to assume they want my trinkets. Yeah.
What is your word for "come with me to a second location"? Yeah. Do you have that? Could you condense that into one phrase?
Yeah. How do your people say "leave your cell phone behind"? So Carol Delaney gives Christopher big ups for realizing that, quote, "the natives were not speaking gibberish, as later so many Europeans attributed to primitive peoples, and that it was important to learn their language." Yes.
He figured out that humans speak language. Yes.
Christopher Columbus. Yes, one of his many achievements. But still, he and his men were not very good at the task of learning the local language. 6 weeks into their journey, he wrote, quote, "I do not know the language, and the people of these lands do not understand me, nor do I, nor anyone else that I have with me, them. And many times I understand one thing said by these Indians that I bring for another. It's contrary, nor do I trust them much, because many times they have tried to flee. But now, pleasing our Lord, I will see that the most that I can, and little by little I will progress in understanding and acquaintance, and I will have this tongue taught to persons of my household, because I see that up to this point it is a single language." Now, first off, it is like a group of languages, but it's probably broadly like, you know, you go to like the Balkans and there's like the different kind of Serbo-Croatian sort of dialects, and they're all different languages. But like Ukraine, if you speak Ukrainian, you can communicate to someone in Russian with vice versa, right? It's probably is kind of like that. But these are different islands, so you have to assume they are not, in fact, just one single language. But yeah, anyway, it's interesting to me that he's like, there's a lot that's interesting here to me, including the fact that he's like, "I can't trust them very much because they keep running away when I capture them." Weird things I've learned about these people. Don't like kidnapping. Real anti-kidnapping vibes on the natives on these islands.
It's just weird to imagine because I know the way history and human beings work, that there must be areas where I live with a similar level of delusion and I just swallow it. But the idea that he can think that and just be like, "That's weird." Like, how does that not hammer home the core value of, oh, I see, they're like me, they're having the same experience I'm having, but if they were kidnapped, it's just bizarre that people can work their brains that much.
I don't know that I think you do live with that level of delusion. I think we all live with areas in which our level of knowledge is that incomplete. Mm-hmm. But what he's saying is a delusion, and it's a delusion because as both a religious fanatic and an obsessive narcissist, he is incapable of looking at anything that happens to him through any lens other than how it affects his ambitions, right? And so his interpretation of reality has to be tortured and twisted in order to make further those ends, right? No matter what is happening, he has to find a way to translate it in that way. And I don't think you have that, Michael, having known you for a while.
Well, if I'm losing at a video game, I do blame the controller. I think that's very similar.
In his case, the controller is several hundred thousand people with their own culture and religion.
It's weird and bad that they want to not be abducted. It's like,
because I want to abduct them. What is the problem here? Yeah,
I'd call it their fatal flaw. Mm-hmm. Lovely people otherwise.
The fact that he needs to learn this language so that he can better convert and capture them is what convinces, according to Delaney, this is what convinces Columbus that he needs to, quote, take six Indians back with him when he left for Spain so that they could learn Spanish. Now, she assures us that the experience was meant to be reciprocal so that his family could learn that. It's like a gap year cultural exchange for these people. That's how Carol describes it.
It's also the very first iteration of, this is America, speak American, damn it.
They gotta learn Spanish.
They're just gonna learn Spanish. That's just gonna be easier here, I'm gonna be honest.
It is amazing. Like, there is a type of person, and maybe Columbus is the first, that like when you stumble upon, like find yourself in a place surrounded by people who speak and believe differently than you, like your first thought is like, well, I got to make everybody a little bit more like me. This isn't going to do.
Someone's got to help these people in air quotes.
What do you call this place? Lisbon? Nah, that ain't going to work.
No. United Lisbon.
So she describes this as like, yeah, these people are excited to learn from him and he's going to learn from them. And it's just this lovely cultural exchange that's going down.
Oh yeah.
Bear Green describes this as a much uglier process where there do seem to be some Taino who were excited to see Spain, as you'd expect, because again, they're not all one people. And anytime you get like effectively aliens coming, some people are going to be like, well, shit, yeah, I want to see what your home is like. Yeah, I got to see what's going on there, right? The whole process was, in fact, closer to abduction than anything. Quote, on Sunday, November 10th, a dugout canoe arrived with 6 men and 5 women to pay their respects. Columbus returned their hospitality by detaining them. That's Columbus's words, in expectation of returning to Spain with them. He bolstered their number with 7 additional women and 3 boys. He explained his thinking this way. I did this because the men would behave better in Spain with women of their country than without them. His decision, he said, was based on his experiences detaining the inhabitants of Africa's west coast to Portugal. Many times I happened to take men of Guinea that they might learn the language in Portugal, and after they returned, it was expected to make some use of them in their own country, owing to the good company that they had enjoyed and the gifts they had received. But matters never turned out as hoped. The problem, he decided, was that without their women, the men would not cooperate. This time, the result would be different. His latest captives, having their women, will find it good business to do what they are told, and these women would teach our people their language, which, he assumed, is the same in all these islands of India.
That is indistinguishable from an MCU supervillain.
It is, it is.
If we threaten their wives, they'll do what we want.
Now, Michael, you didn't mean to do this, but you actually made it a little bit less fucked up in your head there. So this is an interesting point. In Bear Green's write-up, it just sounds like he has detained these guys with their wives, right? Like he's detained men with the women that they were like in relationships with. Oh, yeah, that's right, buddy. Yeah.
He doesn't. They're interchangeable to him.
I'm gonna quote from another write-up from American Heritage that makes a point I did not see noted elsewhere. And this is them quoting from Columbus's journal. Afterwards, I sent to a house which is in the area of the river to the west, Columbus says in his journal, and they brought back 7 head of women, small and large, and 3 children. I did this because the men would comport themselves better in Spain, having women from their land when without them. So again, he is kidnapping 7 head of women to keep the male captives docile. He uses the phrase, the exact way he writes this is cabezas de mujeres, which is the way you'd say, he's saying 7 head of women. Exactly, the exact same way. Yeah. So number one, that's pretty bad. And number two, he is like...
He doesn't understand that people have individual relationships.
No, he's like, well, I've got guys, I gotta get girls, gotta collect the set. He's just grabbing random women to go with these men.
7 guys, 7 girls.
And because, like, they are all traveling, all of the natives in here travel on canoes from island to island, I don't think he actually even knows that, like, the men and the women come from the same island. Like, he may have grabbed people from different villages and just, like, now you got your women with you. Why aren't you happy? And it's interesting. Spanish historian Jose Asensio writes, quote, and this is a guy kind of writing around the time, this was a great abuse and bad judgment on the part of the admiral, which was to set a most lamentable precedent, an act so apparently trifling, which was to have fatal consequences. And that's interesting because, number one, it does show that, like, people at the time are recognizing this is an abuse and bad. This is, like, a bad thing to do to people. But also, it does say a lot that Asensio calls kidnapping a bunch of people apparently trifling.
Trifling.
Trifling. To think that this minor kidnapping of like a dozen people would lead to bad things.
Minor kerfuffle, if you will. Sticky wicket, that.
Yeah. So anyway, that's pretty bad. Father Las Casas is even more kind of clear when he writes in his Historia, quote, one might ask whether it was not a most grievous sin to pillage with violence women who had their own husbands. Who was to give an accounting to God for the sins of adultery committed by the Indians whom he took with him and to whom he gave those wives as sexual partners? And again, that's also, you could see where Las Casas is, where he's like, well, my God, they've broken the sacred bonds of marriage. Who's going to explain this to God? It's very funny. It's not. So now, again, there are, again, some people here and there who do show interest in hanging out with Columbus. But Columbus was not always interested in the people who wanted to go with him willingly. There's one point in his diary where a canoe with a man, 2 women and 3 kids rows up to his ship. And the man begs to join Columbus and, like, go back to Spain with him. And Columbus is frustrated because the guy is old and can't do hard work. So he's like, well, he's not going to make a very good slave. I don't want this guy. Come on. It's the reason I'm kidnapping the young strapping ones.
Just lying in a hammock, judging people's lives.
Yeah. Now, Michael, you know who won't kidnap random groups of men and women from a culture and jam them into the hold of a sailing vessel together to take back to Seville?
Our sponsor, Big Hammock.
Yeah.
Come on down to Big Hammock.
Hey, hammocks, we didn't start this situation. Yeah, look, all we do is make hammocks now. It's fine.
It's just woven thread.
Yeah. Hammocks, the genocide was created prior to the start of the corporate charter.
That's right. Could it be hammocks that ultimately ended the genocide? Causality? Connection? Yeah. I don't know. I'm just a hammock.
I'm just a, this is just a company selling hammocks. Okay. Here's ads. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild minigames. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often, those of us who don't fit into this dumb, stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing
right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ah, oh, we're back. Michael. So, on every island he visits, Columbus sets himself to the task of erecting gigantic crosses. Delaney notes that this is more evidence that he had no intention to enslave the locals, because, and this is her logic, if he converts them to Christianity, they can't be enslaved, right? So the fact that he keeps building crosses on their land is evidence that he doesn't want them all enslaved, right? He's a good guy.
Oh, yeah. When someone puts a cross up in your yard, it's not threatening or aggressive.
It is historically always a good thing.
Usually.
So Bear Green brings up parts of Columbus's notes that Delaney seems to ignore. At one point in November, he did write that the indigenous people were, quote, very gentle and without knowledge of what is evil, neither murder nor theft, and they are without arms and are so timid that 100 of them flee before one person of ours. He recommended to the queen, quote, your highness ought to resolve to make them Christians, for I believe that if you began, in a short time you would achieve the conversion to our holy faith of a multitude of folk, and would acquire great lordships and riches and all their inhabitants for Spain. Now, the source of these riches is quite clear in his mind. Quote, because without doubt there is in these countries a tremendous quantity of gold. And in case the extent of his meaning hasn't sunk in yet, gold needs to be mined. The indigenous folks acquired the small amounts of gold that they had mainly through like searching riverbeds, right? Sifting through rocks and riverbeds and stuff to find little bits of gold. But to actually take the quantities necessary to fund his conquest of Jerusalem, proper mines would need to be open. And converted indigenous people couldn't be enslaved because, you know, Christians can't be enslaved, but they could be forced to labor in gold mines as part of their taxes to the new
enslavement
empire they are a part of. Exactly.
Is it, is there like assaying technology at this time? Like, is he right that there's a bunch of gold?
I mean, they do find gold, right? Like, okay. He sees, like, when there are, it is like a reasonable conclusion that if you see a bunch of people with little bits of gold, well, somewhere there has to be a place where that gold's coming.
Sure.
From, right.
Okay.
His thinking on that matter is not like delusional or anything. He's seeing pieces of gold and he's like, well, there's got to be a place it's coming from.
But yeah. As far as reasonable conclusions go, he's not making a lot of them. So I just that for a second.
They do find this, that is unfortunately where the story's going. They do find gold mines. So on November 11th, the Admiral's fleet anchors off the coast of Cuba, which he thinks again is Japan. He and his men quickly put to shore, expecting to find gold. This was where all the people he'd met in islands along the way had told him the gold came from. But only a few of the folks he meets on the shore are wearing gold jewelry, and again, it tends to be pretty small pieces of gold jewelry. Now, Columbus is seriously starting to worry at this point. He's burning through days, he can't stay out here forever, and he can't just return with some gold trinkets, he feels, because that's not going to be enough to entice the king and queen. So increasingly, he starts to focus on what he's come to see as the most readily available source of wealth in this new world, which is its people, right? If I can't find gold, I can at least take and sell the people. From a write-up in American Heritage, quote, on Monday, December 3rd, the Admiral assured the sovereigns that 10 men could cause 10,000 of the natives to flee. So cowardly and faint-hearted are they, and they carry no arms except some rods at the end of which are pointed sticks, which are fire-hardened. And again, Delaney is like portraying him as in love with these people and building these deep relationships. And everything he's writing is like, we could fuck these guys up. No problem. They can't stop us. We're gods here.
It's just it's wild that he's like, I don't know. You want to make them our religion? You want to use them as slaves? You want some rocks? Like, look, whatever.
What's
you need,
important
man.
Is they're here and we can fuck them up.
I mean, he's literally is willing to denude the landscape that he's discovering of whatever.
As long as he gets what he, you know, something valuable. Now, by December 16th, his ideas in this respect have taken definite form. Quote, and here's Columbus again. They have no weapons and are all naked without any skill in arms and are very cowardly so that 1,000 would not challenge 3. Thus they are useful to be commanded and to be made to labor and sow and do everything else of which there is need and build towns and be taught to wear clothes and learn our customs.
I call them thinky gold. They can be taught to walk and speak as a man.
It is also like you come across these people and you recognize, wow, everyone here looks very healthy and very happy. And their food is delicious and it's like a paradise. You know what would be great is teaching them how to labor and forcing them to build towns and wear pants.
Yeah. Well,
you hate to see it.
it's the seesaw. I don't think his interest is improving their lives.
It is not. Now, I want to contrast these things, which Columbus writes himself during his travels, with how Carol Delaney describes the exploration of Cuba/Japan by Columbus. Quote, "He sent some men ashore, giving instructions as usual, that if the natives fled at their approach, the men must not touch or take anything from their houses. From the very beginning, Columbus notes how generously the natives shared whatever they had, and he did not want his crew to take advantage of them. He demanded that there must be an exchange, for example, beads and bells for needed food supplies. It was unequal, to be sure, but trade nonetheless. He continually recounts having to restrain his crew from looting villages when the residents fled at their approach. Throughout the diary, he repeats, 'I did not allow anything to be taken, not even the value of a pin.'" Now, it's interesting because she's not wrong in that he does repeatedly tell his men not to loot. He writes regularly right. back to his sovereigns that "I said not to loot." But when you just include that part of the story, you get this vision of like a guy who's really just trying to meet people and explore, and he's constantly dealing with the fact that his men are unethical and want to just rob things.
I would already question why you have a corporate culture where everyone under you is like champing at the bit to loot.
Exactly. But when, because what Carol has done here is cut out every time he's written like, boy, literally three of us could beat all of these people in a war, and then we could own them and make them work for us. Like,
I'm
when
not
you cut,
gonna kill yeah. you. But like that, dude, like that.
Yeah, it would be so easy, right? Yeah. So again, when you're leaving all that out, perhaps you are doing a disingenuous job of writing about a guy's backstory. I'm not an anthropologist like Carol Delaney, but I see that as perhaps missing a key part of the story. Now, one thing we're not going to be getting into a lot in these episodes is the story of the Pinzon brothers. Delaney leaves them out mostly, too. All she kind of notes is that in late November, Martin Alonso Pinzon, who's the captain and owner of the Pinta, right? All of these ships had other guys who owned them. They were just kind of in service to the Spanish crown. He abandons the fleet out of greed, right? Like, not that long after they arrive, he takes the Pinta and he just goes separately and does his own thing for a while. And she makes Pinzon out to be basically the villain of the Columbus story, this dangerous, incompetent buffoon who tries to like ruin, he's trying to like steal gold while he's away, and he's not listening to Columbus. And it is true that Pinzon takes the Pinta and kind of leaves the fleet and returns to Spain eventually, like separately. It is inaccurate to portray him as some buffoonish foil. Pinzon and his brothers basically handled all of the expedition's logistics. Martin Pinzon was the only reason Columbus was able to find a crew. He was a very respected sailor in Palos, and he basically convinced others to join the journey. Interviews we have with crew members and their families from a later court case between the two suggest that he basically ran all of the day-to-day business of the expedition because Columbus wasn't good at it and no one trusted him. Evidence that maybe people were right not to trust Columbus as an expedition leader comes right around Christmas when the Santa Maria sinks like a motherfucker off the coast of what is today Haiti. Now, the precise cause of the accident is unclear, and it is partly unclear because Columbus wrote and revised his own account of the disaster repeatedly in order to, like, blame different people. At first, he blames the ship's boy, who he says is at the tiller at the wrong time and screws up. But as time goes on, he starts to claim that the ship hit an invisible reef while he slept. And then finally, as Bear Green writes, quote, "Now he insisted it was caused by the treachery of the master and the people," he's talking about Pinzon here, "in refusing to run out the anchor from stem to kedge, that is haul, off the ship as the admiral ordered. There was no more mention of the hapless boy at the tiller, or Columbus's fatigue, or the holiday celebrations. Treachery had taken their place." So basically, he's having issues with his crew. A lot of them trust these Pinzons, and like one of the Pinzon brothers fucking leaves with his guys. And Columbus initially is like, this thing sank because we were celebrating for the holiday, and like I was tired, we didn't like pay enough attention. Then he's like, no, it was this boy. And then he's like, no, it was treachery from the men of Palos who wanted to ruin the expedition and like didn't do what I told them to. I don't know. I think Columbus maybe literally fell asleep at the wheel. Like, it is entirely possible that he just kind of like passes out and the Santa Maria crashes.
Just, yeah.
But yeah, anyway, it's very funny. And what's interesting here is that kind of by that last revision of the story, what we're seeing is an increasingly paranoid Christopher Columbus, because he's under a lot of stress. He has to justify this expedition. And he also has come to increasingly believe that like God is directing him, right? God brought him here and he is like achieving a sacred end for the Lord.
Finally a good turn in the story, because God's good. God's gonna know what to do. This is gonna be great.
Well, God is telling him that all of the crewmen he has are conspiring against him to stop him from achieving his goals. So The good news is that Columbus, his men, and most of their possessions get rescued by a local leader, a cacique, which is kind of, I don't know, vaguely speaking, it's like a chief, right? A cacique is like kind of a local, kind of villager town level leader. Some, they seem to have pretty widely differing kind of like numbers of people following them.
Sure,
like,
middle management?
No, I mean, definitely, no, I don't know. It doesn't look like there's like a long chain. But yeah, one of these guys is named Guacanagari. And Guacanagari is either, depending on kind of how you interpret things, either one of these guys who sees the Spaniards as maybe semi-divine, or he's just a very savvy local politician who sees them as powerful military allies against his enemies, right? He recognizes, well, these guys have good weapons, and if I get in their good books, they will help protect me from my enemies, right? So after he rescues Columbus and his men from this sinking, he offers to build houses for the admiral and his men and like let them live there. And he presents them with several gold gifts. Like he gives them kind of some of the biggest pieces of gold Columbus has found. And he tearfully expresses his intense desire for friendship. Now, Carol Delaney writes about this at length and presents it as a beautiful example of platonic cross-cultural love between these two men.
It was made into a Charlie Brown special, if I recall.
Exactly. He and Guacanagari are like just the best of buds. Bear Greene's writing makes it clear that the cacique was motivated as much by realpolitik as anything else. Quote, striding past groves of trees next to the houses, the Spaniards found themselves escorted to their guest quarters by a good 1,000 people, all naked, except for Guacanagari, who, out of respect for his guests, now wore a shirt and gloves that the admiral had given him, and over the gloves he made more rejoicing than anything. They talked of strategic matters, of the Indians' fierce rivals, the Caribs, who carried bows and arrows, reminiscent of the Spaniards' exotic weapons, but made without any iron, and of the way the Caribs captured the Indians at will. At once, the admiral said by signs that the sovereigns of Castile would order the Caribs to be destroyed, and would order them all brought with their hands bound. To reinforce his show of strength, Columbus ordered a Lombard and musket to be fired. The two shots, powered by gunpowder technology unknown to the Indians, shattered the Caribbean calm, and the Indians fell to the earth. So this guy's like, you can stay here, we can be friends, you know, by the way, would you help us out with these local enemies of ours who are like raiding us and taking some of our people captive? Mm-hmm. And Columbus is like, oh, once I tell the queen this, you know, she's going to approve a genocide, we'll wipe them out, don't worry, look at our guns. And this is going to be noteworthy later, because now that the Caribs are kind of in the picture, we've established basically everyone he's met before is like peaceful and friendly. Mm-hmm. The Caribs are not peaceful, or at least it is. They have agendas.
They're doing things.
They can at least be portrayed that way. And if there is a group of people here who are aggressive, well, then suddenly a whole world of military options opens up, right?
I guess that's like me sticking my fist into a wasp's nest and going, well, this means war.
this means war.
You see that I had no choice.
That is basically what happens here. Now, the show of modern arms has two purposes for Columbus. For one thing, obviously, it does establish his value as an ally to this guy, but it also acts as a show of force to Guacanagari and his people, because with the Santa Maria sunk, Columbus doesn't have space on his boats to take all of his people back to Spain. But when the cacique offers him a home on the island, the admiral is like, well, wait a second, I can make a fortress here. Like, I can leave some guys behind, we can fortify it, and I'll have built the first strong point for Spanish power in the region. It'll be like the start of our trading system and stuff throughout the islands. Mm. And Columbus now, because he's kind of taken with this vision, he starts to see the loss of his flagship, the sinking of the Santa Maria, as divinely inspired. He decided, quote, preordained to run aground and to meet Guacanagari. And while his initial mission had been simple exploration, he was obligated now by holy fiat to actually start colonizing this new land. Quote, now I have given orders to erect a tower and a fortress, all very well done, and a great moat. Not that I believe it to be necessary for these people, for I take it for granted that with this people I could conquer all this island, which I believe to be bigger than Portugal and double the number of inhabitants. So he's like, I'm building a fortress, even though I don't really need one, right? Like, yeah. I could conquer it without one, but I'm going to make one. Now, of the people who were already there, Columbus showed now no real pretense of kindness. He described them as cowardly and beyond hope of cure. It is right that this tower should be built, he insisted. And it is as it should be, being so far from your highnesses, that they may recognize the skill of your highness's subjects and what they can do, so that they may serve them with love and fear. So he's like, part of what he's saying here is that the reason we should build a fortress here is to show these people, is to have, is to provide a physical, like a physical example of the power of the Spanish crown, right?
Right.
We don't need this fortress because to defend ourselves from them, because they're harmless. What we need it for is that they never forget that now they're subjects of the king
fear.
And queen. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We
exactly.
are Pennywise. We live yeah. off their fear.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to build us a little Death Star in the middle of their nice little Caribbean island so they never forget that the Empire's on their fucking
it
neck
absolutely
now.
Absolutely is. Yeah, yeah. Begin yeah. construction on the yeah. dome, the Death
that,
Dome.
That is his brilliant idea. So he leaves about 40 of his guys there to create a new settlement, and they're meant to build up infrastructure using native labor to help and collect gold for Spain that's going to be there upon their return. Carol Delaney writes that the men he left behind were just super jazzed for the opportunity. Quote, while once his men had desperately feared they would not be able to return to Spain, they now began to haggle over who would be fortunate enough to stay on the island while Columbus and the rest of the crew would attempt to return to Spain on the tiny Niña. So that's good. Now, yeah. Michael, let's think here. Let's war game this out, right? You've got these people who Columbus has already said every single time they come upon a village without people in it, he has to stop them from stealing, right?
Right.
And now he's like, I'm going to leave some of you here alone with weapons. And
no, sure.
They're all suddenly very excited to be in that crew. Do you think they have plans?
Meanwhile, I'm going to put this fox and this grain and this duck in my boat all together, and I'm going to go over there. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think maybe something bad might be about to happen with these guys? But you know who would never rob an island of people blind? Because
I don't think physically possible, if you're going to say what I think you're going to say. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. The products and services that support this podcast. When sets up the island that you can hunt children on, which, by the way, Michael, you and I should hang out on one of these days. It's a great, great place for a vacation.
Oh, any excuse to
they're
see
not, they're not robbing their island off the coast of Indonesia. They're creating value, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That island was just uninhabited by anything other than people when they came here, and now they've turned it into a hunting preserve. You know, that's value, right? That's
creating
wealth.
Well, before then, we weren't aware that cloth could be cut in the shape, that apron shape. Isn't it worth it for the apron?
Yeah, the apron alone.
Apron technology.
Has made their island worthwhile. Michael, here's some ads. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often, those of us who don't fit into this dumb, stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back. So, you know, Columbus is, it's interesting here because, like, he's leaving these guys behind, and a lot of them are very excited to get to stay on the island and get up to the shit they're going to get up to. But it's also worth noting that, like, Columbus is potentially dooming them all based on his own vanity and desire for advancement, because he's very good at navigating, right? He has navigated his way to and through the Caribbean with extreme facility, but the notes that he's written on how to get there and back are totally nonsense from a nautical point of view. Purposefully, he has written the wrong way to get there and back in his notes because he doesn't want to risk getting intercepted by a foreign power and giving them directions to the New World, right? Now, that's reasonable in a way, right? Because this is a valuable secret.
And, wouldn't you do it in code or in some way that you could still understand where you're going?
Well, he can. He knows how to get there and back.
Okay, great.
But no one else, so here's the thing though. He's leaving all these dudes behind. And no one else is going to be able to find them again. To have died on the voyage, and people died for no fucking reason back then, all of those guys would have just been doomed.
It's also the screenwriter in me just can't get over what a huge turn in, like, dooming so many lives that moment is where he decides in his sick little brain, I was supposed to stay here. Why? Yeah. Because I'm supposed to take dominion of this land, of all of it. And you're like, dun, dun, dun. Fuck.
But it is funny that he is essentially gambling the lives of his men on the hope that he, a middle-aged guy in the 1400s, isn't going to, like, die and leave them stranded forever.
I find that
also funny. Obviously, that's not a particularly great crime in the Columbus canon, but it does say a lot about him as a dude that he just doesn't even think about it. Not for a second. is there an ounce of concern?
What if we need to get back? What, you know, left at the big rock or whatever.
Yeah,
I
man,
gotta
you
go.
Just say, like, come on, figure it out. So Columbus begins his journey home on January 2nd, 1493, but despite days of begging from the cacique that he stay to provide protection from the Caribs. Before he left, he christened his new settlement on Hispaniola, Navidad, and wrote in a letter to his sovereigns that when he returned to the island, he was sure that he would, quote, find a barrel of gold that those who were left behind would have acquired by exchange, and that they would have found the gold mine and the spicery, and those things in such quantity that the sovereigns, before 3 years are over, will undertake to go and conquer the Holy Sepulchre. For this I urged your highnesses to spend all the profits of this my enterprise on the conquest of Jerusalem.
Oh, all right, so Nexium.
It's
going to be great. It's going to change the world. Guaranteed.
Well, because what he's saying here is that I'm leaving them on the island to to collect gold and find a mine and find spices. Which, number one, Carol Delaney is like, he just wanted them there to watch his friend and to set up a settlement so people could live there.
Essentially set up a human Bitcoin mine.
Yeah, that's actually what he's doing. And he's doing it all for Jerusalem, baby. So one of the last things Columbus did was he delivered a letter to the man he was leaving in charge of Navidad. It contained instructions and was signed. Instead of with Columbus's usual signature, it was signed with something new. This is the first time he starts using instead of like his signature is this bizarre glyph that he invents for himself during the voyage.
Sexy.
And he creates this like glyph to sign things with because he's now grown convinced that he's being guided by God to some holy end. And here's how Carol Delaney describes this. The sigil resembles a ship in full sail and consists of three rows of letters in the shape of a triangle. The meaning of the last line is clear. Expo Ferens is a combination of Greek and Latin words, meaning Christ-bearer. Columbus must have believed that he had made good on his identification with his namesake, St. Christopher. Though during the voyage, Columbus must have given much thought to the letters and their arrangement, to this day they remain undeciphered, despite the efforts of many people through the ages. One interpretation is that the initials stand for Servus at the top, and then Sum Altissimi Salvadoris on the second line, and Christe Maria Jesu on the third, all of which translates as, I am the servant of the Most High Savior, O Christ, Mary Joseph. Another interpretation is, Servidor sus Aztecas sacras Christo Maria Isabel, that is, the humble servant of their most sacred majesties, Christ, Mary, and Isabella. So he's kind of gone full extremist here. He's like built himself a logo that number one, he's like primarily identifies himself.
Shit,
yeah, he is
by the way.
he is signing himself now as like the agent of God, right?
Yeah.
Like the person who is going to like bring about the apocalypse and
bring about
the conquest of Jerusalem. Yeah.
He like put it in a little cool triangle.
He's spending a lot of time locked in his room writing.
Figured it out. Yeah.
We never got his notes, his little trapper keeper as he figured out how to
do it. The alternate ones and takes and little shit he was gonna doodle.
Anyway, that's that. We're now at like full Christ bearer Columbus, who is number one convinced that he and he and the sovereigns now own this place, right? Because again, part of his deal with them is that if they take it, he gets to be the governor and he gets a cut of all the profits. And he's also convinced that he is being directly guided by God to take possession of this in order to fund a holy war. So that's
it. Good. Is striking. Mm-hmm. How often people who have acquired or are on the verge of acquiring completely unevenly levered like advantage over something or to suck a huge amount of resource up suddenly decide that it's good this is happening and God wants this to happen and it's great and that's why it's fine. I love it. I love being on the show, Robert. I'm glad this is all we ever do together, after episode.
Yes. Next, we will be talking about Christopher Columbus's feet. Now, this is largely going to be based on, my personal theories / erotic dreams. But
right.
I think people will still get a lot out of it, Michael. I hope you do.
I'm turgid, so let's go.
You have any plugs you want to plug before we roll out?
God, not after that. Thanks for the opportunity, Robert. Always have a blast here. My name's Michael Swaim. You can find me on Twitter mostly at Swaim_Corp. And if you want to hear me on a whole variety of podcasts, search up Small Beans, which is the name of my imprint, or head over to patreon.com/smallbeans. I've also got another show that's not on that network called One Upsmanship, a brand new video games podcast on the iHeart Network. Check it out if you're interested in video games as an art form, because that's what we think it is. By we, I mean myself and my co-host Adam Ganser. Again, that's the number one. And then UPSmanship. Check it out.
Excellent. All right, the episode's over. Go home, everybody.
Woo-hoo!
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.